We have something extra special and a little bit unexpected for you. As part of the Plymouth Festival of Words, James and I recorded our first ever Histories of the Unexpected live, and you can now download it on iTunes for just 99p at historyhit.com/unexpected live.
If you download it, you will hear about the history of signatures, which of course is all about the reign of Henry VIII, forgery and rebellion. You'll also hear about the history of clocks, which is about the Industrial Revolution, and how could we forget it, the history of the Reformation.
Everything's about the Reformation with you. And it's also, of course, about nuclear weapons and the Titanic.
Of course it is. So everybody, go to iTunes today and download our special Histories of the Unexpected Live, or go to historyhit.com/unexpected live.
This is Histories of the Unexpected.
He's the famous historical adventurer Dr. Sam Willis.
And he's Professor Extraordinaire of Early Modern British History at Plymouth University. He is Professor James Daybell.
And we are your hosts for Histories of the Unexpected.
Each week we discuss a surprising subject oozing with unexpected historical significance. And this week, it's the ring.
Which is all about the history of pugilism, trade wars, love and the marketing of romance.
And archery.
And archery.
If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, and tell all of your friends. We're on Twitter. You can follow me at Dr. Sam Willis.
And you can follow me at James Daybell. And you can follow Histories of the Unexpected on Unexpected Pod. We are proud to be part of the excellent History Hit Network, home of Dan Snow's History Hit and other great shows.
And you can find out more about what we've got planned in the forthcoming months, show notes, video clips, photos of everything we discuss, and much, much more at historyhit.com/unexpected. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to episode 37, or at least we think it's 37, of Histories of the Unexpected, where we will be audio googling through history, exploring the histories of things you didn't even know had a significant story to tell, like the history of dogs, frames, and vests.
Vests. I can't wait for that.
And
I can't wait for vests. And we'll be following the links in our minds as we come across them, explaining how everything, simply everything, has a history, and crucially, how those histories link together in unexpected ways. Who knew, for example, Sam, that the history of the bookcase, we are in a room crammed with Billy bookcases. Who knew that that was all about the world of knowledge, about power, and about chained books? Oh, and secret doors.
Very good. The man sitting opposite me is the entertainer of the Enlightenment. He's Professor James Daybell.
And the man sitting opposite me is the Elvis of events. It is the very wonderful Dr. Sam Willis.
Together, we will be piloting you on this uncharted and frankly highly dangerous flight into the past. Each week, one of us takes the lead, and this week, it's my turn.
So, Sam, what have you got for us this week?
Well, I've got something that was inspired by something I read on a notice board last week. It's the history of rings.
The history of rings.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So, check this out. I was at a golf club, and we're doing a family kind of golf competition, which I won, I just want to say. There was this note on the notice board, and it was one of the saddest notes I'd ever seen. Lost somewhere between the third and seventh tee, an emerald and diamond ring. If found,
God,
please return
worst
to Cynthia.
Nightmare.
And,
losing a ring like that.
I know.
That it, valuable.
Yes, it made me slightly kind of sweat. It was awful.
Did you find it?
No, but my kids wanted to go out and go and find this ring so they could sell it on eBay. No, it's obviously...
You're training them well.
I am training them well. The emotional importance of this ring, the value of the ring, really got me thinking about things, and also about found rings, about discovered rings, because if you work as a historian and archaeologist, you come across rings a lot.
Yeah.
Particularly with my work through the discovery of shipwrecks, which I'll talk about later. And
yeah.
This idea of finding a ring and then trying to sort of piece together the history of it or work out what it can tell you was really interesting. Do you wear a ring?
I do. I wear a wedding ring quite consciously. My father didn't have a wedding ring, but later in life got a signet ring.
Right.
Was given it as a birthday present and wore it. But it was a very conscious choice. I think it's very important as a sort of symbolism of a ceremony and a relationship.
Yeah.
to display that.
Yeah. So I wear a signet ring.
I'm very proud of it.
I've got mine has my initials on it. Got a little S and a W there.
Is that a family tradition?
Yep. So my dad had one. His father had one. His father had one. So all of the Willis men had it. And then my sister had a bit of a fit when she realised she wasn't going to get one. So she's got one as well.
I can believe.
Yeah, yeah. Because I wear on my little finger of my left hand, I don't wear a wedding ring because then I'd have two rings together and they'd
clinking.
Kind of bash into each other and clink. So,
does your wife wear a wedding ring?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah. An engagement ring as well.
So rings.
Rings. They have a fascinating and long, really long history. If you think about it archaeologically, you can trace them back to, you know, ancient civilizations, and they have really distinct meanings. That's one of the interesting things about them is that they're used to pledge love, to seal correspondence, to authenticate documents. They're tokens of memorialization, of friendship. They honor the dead. You know, so you've got these sort of memento mori rings. In certain cultures, they are they're talisman. They're possessed of sort of protective powers. They can symbolize power. Think of royal rings, the royal signet. Think of bishop's ring and the kissing of the bishop's ring. So it's all about that. They express faith, symbolize power. And we also have, you know, we've talked already about signet rings. We've talked about, you know, engagement rings, wedding rings. But there are a whole variety of rings.
It's like a classic example of a history of the unexpected. You know, the whole purpose of what you do. You know, everyone, I just wake up, put my ring on, don't really think about it. I actually very rarely take it off.
I never take it off.
No.
I fiddle with it, though.
Yes. No, I do as well.
I'm a nervous fiddler.
And I lost it once, and then I found it again in a gardening glove, and I'd taken it off when I took my gardening gloves off. Hmm. That gave me a fright.
When you got your doctorate, did you get a doctoral ring?
No. Did you?
No, I didn't. But in Denmark and Sweden, are people with doctorates.
Is that like the Super Bowl in America?
I imagine it's slightly classier than the Super Bowl ring. I'm heading to Sweden next week to visit a wonderful friend at the University of Lund, whose his PhD comes from. He's a Swedish PhD, so I shall ask to have a look at his doctoral ring.
That's interesting.
I will take a picture of it, and I will post it on Twitter for everyone.
Good. And everyone, send in your photos of the jewellery on your hand.
Gadget rings.
Excellent. What's a gadget ring?
Gadget rings, sort of like little spy rings. I'm sure, you know,
kind of bombs in it.
No, we're with secret compasses and sort of little tobacco pouches and
I tell you where they'll have those. That's at the royal armories.
I was thinking of that. Yes, yeah. If you weaponize a ring,
yeah,
I'm sure you could. How do you read a ring? This is one of the big things. This is a podcast that often talks about things and how do we approach things. How do you approach? Say you take a ring like this.
Yeah.
What's the first thing you do?
Well, the first thing I might do is look inside it.
So you're looking for, that's the typical historian, you're looking for writing.
Yeah, and I have
inscriptions.
I have my, that's not my birthday. No, so that's...
somebody else's ring.
Somebody else's ring, I've been wearing all my life. That's the date I was 18. So I'd look inside it. You'd look at whether it was it's particularly worn. You'd look at what it was made of,
size.
The size, absolutely. You can tell a great deal from that. I mean, mine's obviously very worn, and you can see that it's been loved and cherished and bashed as well. Anyway, so just while I'm holding this, one of the things that really got me thinking about this is I was doing some work on two things. One was the Armada. And the other is a early 17th century shipwreck in the Caribbean called the Atocha. The Atocha got wrecked in 1622. It was a treasure ship coming from South America.
Hmm.
It was how the Spanish funded their empire. So they had these amazing silver mines, they had emeralds, they had gold, and they were bringing it all across to Spain, funded the economy, and allowed them to build navies, among other things, and armies. So the Spanish were kind of funded by treasure. Extraordinarily.
Treasure ships.
Yeah. We borrowed money. We basically mortgaged ourselves up to the hilt against the value of trade.
And our privateers intercepted these
and
treasure ships.
Stole it all. But it's a very interesting different way of funding empires.
Mm.
One of these ships goes down and then it was found again by a guy who used to be a chicken farmer. And he became obsessed with this ship and found it. And you know, it made him...
Not in the middle of a chicken field.
Not in the middle of a chicken field, no, but off the sea in Florida. But it made him, you know, $40 million. very famously.
Right.
So here's one of those rings. Absolutely
stunning.
Exquisite.
Is that an emerald in the middle?
Emerald.
Square cut.
Square cut, large. Those are not small emeralds.
And, a bling ring.
It absolutely is. And as well as these kind of rings, they found sort of emeralds like golf balls in chests. Quite extraordinary.
Gosh.
So that one got me thinking about what was kind of the association between rings and shipwreck, because it is very strong. There's another one here, and that one's from the Armada. Along with a lot of other jewellery that's been discovered from wrecks from the Armada. They're all gold. Gold can just live under the sea for ages and ages and ages. Nothing happens to it. It's one of the kind of distinctive things about it. It's why it's a slightly magical thing for maritime archaeologists. This has two hands clasped together and the inscription, "No tengo más que darte." I have nothing left to give you. I have been really interested in this because particularly the Atocha, the Girona wreck, which is this Armada one, you get a sense of the soldiers and the sailors of the Spanish Armada going to their deaths heavily laden with exquisite jewellery. That matters for two reasons. One is that there's a whole kind of shadowy mass of normal sailors who weren't kitted out like this.
Yeah.
But the other one is this idea of sailors wearing finger rings, which is exceptionally dangerous and quite an odd thing to do. I found a quote. Basically, if you get your hand trapped or pulled on a bit of rope,
I can imagine.
You can get these horrific injuries. One of them is called it's called a ring avulsion injury, and it is it's known as degloving.
Oh, you don't have pictures of this, do you?
No, I don't actually. But
I can imagine literally pulling all the
skin off your finger, and it leaves it leaves a bone.
I've just had a shiver go down my spine from that.
This is a quote of some poor sod who was sailing and hurt his finger. "The water was a lot deeper than I thought, or for some reason the anchor didn't bite, so I fed more rope out, and all of a sudden the anchor bedded in, boat moving about 5 or 6 knots at this point, and the rope crushed my fingers together and tore the top off my ring. I somehow managed to extract my fingers from the rope. 3 fingers on each hand were broken. Needless to say, things went from bad to worse at this stage, as I was single-handed and without the use of either of my hands. My index finger was nearly torn off and had to be operated on to rejoin the bone and repair other internal tissue damage. I learned a lot of lessons that day." I bet you did. Well, one of which is obviously you don't wear rings on boats. So this kind of idea of rings being dangerous, I've become slightly obsessed with. And I've been looking through portraits of naval captains, English naval captains, and none of them wear rings. And I reckon that if I don't know the answer to this.
Naval captains wouldn't be up the rigging to kind of doing those sort of things, though, would they?
No, but they would have, even officers would have been moving around deck, and you're near moving stuff near all the time.
Yeah.
I reckon if you went onto one of the English ships, I would like to suggest that I don't think an English sailor would be wearing rings on his fingers because of the dangers of having it. So I think two of the really interesting points about rings is one is found rings, and that's how much of history we learn from rings that have just been discovered in fields or golf courses or shipwrecks. And two is this idea about rings being dangerous and how that has kind of changed over history.
Fascinating. I want to take rings in a completely different direction. And I want to talk about wedding rings, engagement rings, the invention of the diamond engagement ring, which is a relatively late phenomenon.
What is it?
20th century phenomenon. I mean, we can trace the wedding ring band, which you give to somebody as a sort of indication of marriage. The earliest we've got, we can trace back to ancient Egypt. We can also see them in ancient Rome and Greece. And there are various sort of styles. I've got some examples here from the 16th and 17th century. We've got the fede ring, or the hand ring, here, which we've got an example here from the Victoria and Albert Museum.
It's a bit like the one we've got
it's,
here.
It's exactly like the one you've got.
So it's two clasping hands which provide the lock.
Two clasping hands which provide the lock. And sometimes these open out so that you have three interconnecting bands that are joined by a hand, which you can see here. Yeah. We've got two bands there. Or you have the posy ring.
That's beautiful. That, I mean, that looks like the Lord of the Rings ring.
It does. The one ring to
yeah,
to
so
rule
it's very
all.
Smooth. It's gold and it's got kind yeah. of beautiful calligraphic script yeah. inside it. How do you do that? I mean, the manufacturer of rings is interesting. I mean, I have no idea how you engrave the inside of a ring.
It's like those people that put their name on a grain of rice.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know. But I mean, the symbolism here, though, is the symbolism of the ring suggesting, you know, eternity, it being a circle. And also the sort of motto inside it, I think, is really telling. Providence divine hath made. And you can collect all sorts of little verses that you see on wedding rings from the period. I've got a couple of others here. The Bodleian, not the Bodleian Library, the Ashmolean Library in Oxford has quite a good collection. Love is fixed, I will not range. I like my choice, I will not change. Wit, health and beauty all do dwell, but constant love doth far excel. That's a hell of a lot to put on the inside of a ring. But it's really important, and people remember what they put on wedding rings. I was in the Bodleian a couple of years ago, just working on a book called Family and Materials of Memory, which will be out in a decade, I think. It's a very, very big project, but just calling up all sorts of random manuscripts and miscellanies. And there was this one wonderful collection connected to Hannibal Baskerville, who is a 17th century antiquarian. And he records one of his godfather's sort of lives. And in the life, as he's telling his life, he refers to the godfather's two wives and the inscriptions on their wedding ring. Now, the first wife is love is little worth. Her surname was Worth, so it's a sort of pun on that. The second wife is called Constance. Constant, be constant, thy life resplendent. But it's this idea, I mean, it's both of them are sort of ridiculous and punning, but it's this sense that it's seen to be worth recording. In 1549, in the Book of Common Prayer, we see the ring coming into the service. With this ring I thee wed, which is followed by this gold and silver I give thee. So it's sort of, you know, I think it's about marriage being a sort of a contract. It's almost a sort of an economic relationship. The other interesting thing is which finger you wear your wedding ring on. Do you know the reason why it's the fourth finger on the left hand?
No, I do not know why.
It is supposed to be the heart vein, the vein or nerve that leads directly to the heart. So it's associated with romance. Henry Swinburne, in a 17th century book on marriage, coins this. So it's deeply...
Is it actually the heart vein? Is that a made-up vein? Is that what they thought it was?
I imagine it isn't.
I imagine it isn't as well. But what a weird... You know, if you're going to work out and reckon that that's what it is, their thought process behind that would be really interesting. There'd be a reason for it.
I think anatomists have traced a sort of a vein that comes from here and sort of goes... But I think it was deemed to be that before people actually started opening people up and checking where the veins went.
I love that, though. They're not exactly guessing. There would have been some kind of reason based on how they thought the body worked.
The engagement ring, which is where I was going. The invention of the engagement ring, of course, is related to Tiffany's, and Tiffany diamonds is relatively modern. And it's connected to De Beers in the late 19th century, diamond mines in South Africa. And basically the market was flooded with diamonds and some bright sparks in the US, in New York.
So is this the 1910s?
This is the late 19th century.
Oh, right.
But then the market gets flooded. And then in the early 20th century... some ad agency and marketing people, were kind of wondering, how on earth do we sell this how on earth do we sell all of these diamonds that have flooded the market? And so a New York ad agency, NW Ayer, basically starts a marketing campaign to persuade people to buy rings. And I've got an example here in Reader's Digest, which is a 1960 De Beers ad in Reader's Digest, which shows a woman underneath a tree lying on the ground with a bling.
She's stoned with happiness, how I would describe it. She's just sort
quite
of
literally
punning
on stoned. And the size of the engagement ring, particularly in North America, is incredibly important and is all about status. But what's interesting, I have here, and I apologize for this, for introducing a set of graphs.
He's showing me graphs.
In here. I'm showing him graphs. God. But this is absolutely fascinating, because what it shows is the way in which diamond engagement rings have spread across the world, the fashion for it. So it started in the US. So in 1940, about 10% of women wore diamond engagement rings. By 1990, it is over 80%.
Wow.
Of people. So it has really spread. Have a look at this. We then move to Japan. Japan is slightly behind the curve. In 1965, 5% of people wear rings. 1995, 77%.
Blimey.
Percent of wearings. Now, here's the interesting thing. China. You know, we know a lot about the sort of advancement of China. We know a lot about the markets being opened up, you know, and what we see here is effectively the export of this sort of engagement ring culture. 1994, you know, very, very few people are wearing, you know, engagement rings. We've got about 1 or 2% here. By 2010, over 30%.
Ooh, it's coming,
So it's coming, that's, and it's rising. And think about the enormous market there.
Yeah, yeah. I love a good graph. And that's an excellent one.
That is an excellent graph.
So that's really good. Interestingly, when I bought my wife her engagement ring, we showed it to a friend. She said, lovely, but it's not an engagement ring.
Oh.
And I was like, what a weird thing to say.
How disappointing.
It's so rude. Yes. It is an engagement ring.
Why was it not an engagement
because
ring?
Because she envisaged an engagement ring to be a slim band with a massive diamond on it.
Right.
I bought Tours a friendship ring.
Oh.
But as far as I'm concerned, it was a engagement ring. And it's got jewels all the way around it.
But it's people's association with the diamond engagement ring.
Yeah. It was quite a punchy thing to say.
Yeah.
It is actually an engagement ring.
Yeah. There was I remember sitting in the cinema, you know, years ago when there was that you'd get that diamond engagement ring advert. Which was, you know, how could a month's salary last a lifetime?
Yeah. Right, so look at these. I'm just going to kind of carry on my theme.
Ooh, Sam.
I know.
Should we go back to the graphs? Because they're much more sanitized. He's showing me pictures of lopped off fingers here.
So the one on the right is an x-ray from a World War II, I think, soldier who's had the tips of his fingers shot off.
Ooh.
And on the left is a much earlier one. So that's a hand-drawn kind of surgeon's manual on the different types of finger injury you can sustain and how they were dealt with. So one of my points I just want to make very briefly is that whether the injury is caused by rings or not, hands are exceptionally difficult to operate on and to kind of actually rebuild and to actually make work again if you've injured yourself horrifically. And our understanding of it has dramatically changed by warfare. So for the First World War, Second World War.
Mm.
And that's when people who specialised in finger surgery really were forced to change the way that they worked because there were so many soldiers coming in with damaged hands.
It's the same with the Iran and Iraq, the Afghanistan and Iraq
lower limbs,
wars.
Lower limb injuries.
And the medical advancement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So rings are, you know, in that respect, with their association with fingers and finger injury, it is all linked to it. But it also makes me wonder what you'd do if you were wearing a ring. And you've lost your fingers, and then you then have got nowhere to put your ring. So you can
necklace.
Put it on the other hand, or a necklace.
Necklace around your neck.
Yeah, so that's another thing. Lots of people will wear that if they are doing an activity that is physical that would be dangerous because they're wearing a ring. We'll take it off and wear it around their neck as a necklace. So we've gone from found rings to the danger of rings, and damage. So I just want to sort of flip this round the other way and talk about rings as protection. Because you can actually, there's a whole history of people wearing rings to protect their hands. And one of the most interesting things are these. They're absolutely beautiful. And I think if you have any type of ring, these are my favourites. They are Archer's thumb rings from Central Asia.
Gosh, look at those. Those are exquisite.
They are. And they are made out of, they can be made out of leather, stone, horn, wood, bone, ivory, metal, ceramics, a whole variety of things. A lot of them are very jewelled. They are pieces of jewellery in their own right, as well as a functional thing. So it's to do with how the Chinese, Indians, Ottomans fired their bows. So the English used a traditional two- or three-finger draw, pulling it back. But these guys had a thumb ring, and they clipped the edge of the
protective in a very practical sense rather than magical sense.
And you pull it back, and you have your palm down, which is a much more sort of ergonomic way of doing it, and you just flick your fingers. And it is so much more efficient. It is so much more effective. And that is how these all of the Central Asian warriors, the Chinese warriors, Japanese, Korean, Indians, Ottomans, that is how they all fired their bows. But we didn't. We carried on using the technique we used for our longbows for absolutely centuries. And so not only is this an idea of a ring being imported protection, but it's also linked to technology. And I think most interestingly of all, it's linked to one of these examples of technology that wasn't passed down the Silk Road. So when people write and talk about the Silk Road, so much focus is on things that were passed down the Silk Road, like
spices,
and paper, printing presses, mathematics, these kind of a huge flow of cultural exchange. But there's an equally large body of things that weren't. And we still don't really know why. We still don't. I mean, plenty of people knew how they did this and they would have come back, but nothing changed. Whereas in other examples of cultural differences, things changed. So for me, that thumb ring opens up a kind of a really fascinating historical kind of conundrum, which historians have still not quite worked out yet, because of this desire and need to link East with West through cultural exchange, through these ideas, and to prove that East was influential in West, and West was influential in East. But by no means did everything flow that way. No. And there were weird barriers and borders that stopped things.
Yeah.
And I think that's fascinating.
So the East meets West is all about the history of rings.
Yeah.
Yeah, brilliant.
Or not. East doesn't meet West.
Brilliant.
Well, it does only on the battlefield. Yeah.
Brilliant.
What's next?
Well, do you know what? We haven't talked about gloves. and I'm not going to talk about gloves. But gloves came up on Twitter yesterday. Somebody said, how long would it take me to get gloves in to a podcast? Especially for you. I'm thinking about rings and gloves. And one of the things that's always concerned me is what do you... We've talked about the wedding ring. We've talked about... And in the past, we've talked about, gender relations in the 16th and 17th century and women's sort of subordinate position. So one of the questions that's always struck me is what do women do when they go outside and they're wearing gloves? What do they do with their ring? Do they wear their ring underneath?
Interesting.
In which case... nobody knows whether they're married, because one of the reasons that women would have worn a wedding ring was to show that she wasn't single, that she was somebody else's wife. Would she have worn it underneath, in which case it's very difficult to tell, or would she have worn it over the ring? Or would there, in certain cases, you have gloves with slits in them? And you can actually see. Anyway, that's an aside. I wasn't going there. I literally off the top of my head now. I want to talk about rings with meaning.
Right.
So I've got a series of examples here. What do you make of that?
The one on the left or the one on the right?
They're the same ring.
Oh.
That's it. That's it open. This is Elizabeth I's locket ring.
That's great. So it's a gold ring, but with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 20 rubies?
It's got rubies. It's got...
Diamonds,
beautiful and square mother cut. Of pearl.
It looks very modern. The diamond. There's an E for Elizabeth made out of square cut diamonds.
Yeah.
Anyway, that clearly opens up, and inside it is a portrait of
Elizabeth.
Yes.
And of her mother.
Her mother, Anne Boleyn.
Mm-hmm. Anne Boleyn. Aren't you doing something on Henry VIII and love and in politics in a little bit?
We are. I'm doing one of my history masterclasses with Susie Lipscomb. Ah. We are doing Henry VIII in love and war.
Well, it's all about rings. Mm. This is about, you know, Henry VIII's second wife here. You know, very, very key stuff. So this is a ring that is now at Chequers. It has been on display at Greenwich National Maritime Museum as part of an exhibition. And it is thought to be the ring that Elizabeth died in. She died wearing, and it was supposedly removed from her finger when she died on the 24th of March, 1603, by Robert Carey. Mm. He then rode to the Scottish border to present it to James VI of Scotland, who then became James VI of Scotland and James I of England. And, yeah, as you see, it's Elizabeth here and her mother here. Hmm. And, you know, you've got to think about, you know, what is the symbolism, the significance of wearing that? You know, she knows all too well the history of her mother, you know, her mother's tragic fall from power.
But so she's kept it. She's kept it, worn it, but she's kept the memory of her mother very, very close, but she's kept it very, very secret.
But it's secret because it's this. Yeah, I think that's the thing that we need to explain. The E, sort of the front of the ring comes off to reveal these tiny little miniature portraits.
Yeah, which is very common in that period.
Of mother and daughter.
Not very, very common, but there was a fashion to have these miniature portraits.
Yeah.
So, it does kind of, it's
opens
fascinating.
Up. Yeah.
Opens up a window into her history, wondering how and why, how she thought about that relationship.
I want to move on to look at, we're looking at rings with meaning, memento mori and mourning rings. So rings that are designed to commemorate somebody who's died. So a ring that, and what we have here is a 17th century ring. We've got a skeleton there, it's a gold ring.
You've got a skeleton holding a dagger and an hourglass.
And an hourglass.
Which is almost identical to Blackbeard's pirate flag.
It is. but what's even more interesting is the lock of hair in it, which you see behind. So this sort of braid of hair that you can see there. And I think, you know, that's something in itself that is fascinating. Can't remember whether, when we did our podcast on hair, whether we looked at hair as a sort of memento mori and keepsake.
We did. Yeah. I think we did.
Yeah. But absolutely, absolutely amazing example. I was rummaging around in the attics in Powderham Castle in Devon recently and came across lockets of hair. Not in rings, but tucked into little love letters. The final thing that I want to talk about is signet rings.
Yeah.
And I think what we have here is a very sort of practical use of rings. You know, this is we're talking here about a period pre the envelope. When you know, and we've talked about this in the past, when you fold up your letter, you seal it with wax, and you'd seal it with, you know, you have a variety of seals, fob seals, desk seals, but people would have had signet rings that they would have worn around with them, so they would be able to authenticate as they went. And we've got some really fascinating examples of these that survive. One of the most interesting that I've come across is John Donne, the poet, John Donne, late Elizabethan, early Jacobean poet, who has a series of signet rings across his life, a series of seals. They change according to... So the family seal is a sheaf of snakes. There's one with a wolf rampant.
A
sheaf of snakes here. A sheaf of snakes. Right. So like a sort of... You know, like a sheaf of corn.
Except they're snakes.
Except they're snakes' heads.
It's easily the coolest signet ring I've ever seen.
It's wonderful. It's wonderful, isn't it? But when he gets ordained, so he gets into all sorts of trouble. He gets ordained. His signet then changes, and it's Christ crucified on an anchor. So it's to represent that. So it's about sealing correspondence. It's about authentication. It's actually about the pre-signature.
Yeah, brilliant,
incredible.
So one last one. I came across this, which I adore. It's a 15th century ring, but inside it is a Roman jewel, essentially, with a carved...
Is that a scarab or something in there?
It's like a scorpion.
Scorpion.
And this links back to my other idea about rings as protection, but this is rings as spiritual protection, or as rings as a charm.
Lovely.
It was...
Lord of the Rings again.
Yeah, absolutely. This is all to do with protecting yourself from fever and from poison, and all sorts of association between scorpions and water. But what I love about this is this link... is the ring as a link between past and present. So the present, you have this 15th century outside, it's holding it, but in the center is something much, much, much older.
Yeah.
And that ring is a wonderful example of how and why people were fascinated with the ancient world in the 15th and the 16th centuries. And it's exactly the same, actually, with the Spanish ring I began with at the beginning, the gold and the emerald.
Hmm.
And it's why... You can't just sort of say, oh, that's an emerald, and then pass it on. That's actually, that's made by Spanish goldsmiths, but they've put a emerald from South America, which is all linked to the wealth of the Aztecs, into their ring. So that is also a fascinating link between past and present, and it also has this kind of strong symbolism of empire to it, just in the way that this does as well, because it's all to do with the people using the past as a tool of legitimization. So they're studying the past, they're linking themselves physically with the past, they're saying this has happened before. In this case, it's Roman. So they're saying in England, the Romans were here, we're going to do we associate ourselves with this kind of empire building. And it's very similar with the Spanish one. Those rings actually talk about the conquistadors, they talk about the Spanish conquest of South America.
It's also about the quality of craftsmanship, the fact that you've got that kind of, you know, that sort of technology, that advanced technology in order to be able to do this, which suggests something about the civilization in which they're living. You know, the power of it.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
we haven't talked about fairy rings.
Fairy rings.
There are all sorts of things we could have talked about. Fairy rings and, you know, all sorts of things.
So get in touch with your stories about rings. And if you're at Woodbury Golf Course, there's an emerald and diamond ring somewhere between the third and the seventh hole.
Excellent.
Everyone hunt for it and get in touch. Let us know your stories. Thank you very much for listening. Bye.
Bye. Elvis has left the building.
If you enjoy this podcast and you like learning about the past, check out my latest venture. It's called History Masterclass, and it's a new type of historical event where you can actually learn in person from the best historians around today in unique and stunning historical locations. You can find out more at thehistorymasterclass.com and follow on Facebook and Twitter.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Twitter @TheHistoryMC.